a new trial to exonerate his name, and that God has been working through all of us to get justice, not just for him, but for Stacey Stites as well. And that's what we're committed to, and not going to stop until it's done.
Well, I want to thank you all. Go ahead, Roger.
And just, you know, we love him, and we can't wait till our family is whole again.
Roderick Reed, brother of Rodney Reed, Juana Akpan, sister-in-law of Rodney, and Bryce Benjet, senior staff attorney with the Innocence Project. He's been working on the case for 18 years. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Durte, Maria Studio, and Maria Saracena. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was fun. This is KBOO Portland, Oregon. It's 5 o'clock. Coming up is the evening news, but first.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech on Monday, November 18th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Northwest Academy in Portland. Cyrus Farivar, author of the book Hobbyist Data, will speak on legal and privacy history and what our rights are currently, and how law enforcement agencies and companies can collect and use our private details, often without our knowledge. Again, that's Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech with Cyrus Farivar, on Monday, November 18th, from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Northwest Academy, 1130 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an anti-Semitic phone hack at a Portland restaurant, Shalom Yal.
Portland police reject the notion of adding demographic data to reports on force.
And in international news, a major reversal of U.S. policy on Israeli settlements.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 18, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Portland police are investigating a possible hate crime after the phone system at Shalom Yal, a restaurant in southeast Portland, was hacked. At around 6 p.m. on Saturday, someone called the restaurant and threatened an employee over the phone. Shortly thereafter, a customer let management know there was an issue with their answering machine. Shalom Yal's managing partner, Yamal Hassan, quickly checked the answering machine's outgoing message and was shocked to find a robotic voice saying, quote, "Hi, you have reached a stupid Jewish restaurant." The greeting, he says, is, quote, "supposed to welcome everybody to the restaurant. Our name is Shalom Yal. It's for everyone." Instead, the pre-recorded message was anti-Semitic and homophobic, containing explicit and sexually violent remarks about the employees and customers. The restaurant worked with their service provider to fix that problem, but the phone system was hacked again on Sunday. The phone number was also used to make threatening phone calls to two other Middle Eastern restaurants in Beaverton and Hillsboro. Hassan believes the restaurant is being targeted because they serve Israeli food and says they are continuing to operate as usual. Quote, We're not going to let some hateful or bigoted hacker stop us from doing what we do best.
Dozens of students at Westland High School protested homophobic bullying and the presence of a Chick-fil-A truck at a football game on Friday. Protesters, including member of the school's Gender and Sexuality Alliance, flew pride flags in support of their LGBTQ peers and protested recent bullying events, including the vandalism of a transgender student's car. A group of counter-protesters were there to mock the LGBTQ supportive students, wearing Make America Great Again hats and waving Chick-fil-A bags. Susie Walters, one of the protest organizers, told KGW about their objection to the Chick-fil-A truck. She said, quote, "Hate and harassment, we're not going to stand for that anymore. We're going to make sure the school is a safe place for everyone." Chick-fil-A has faced protests elsewhere, too, with activists even forcing the closure of some of their stores abroad. The fast food chain has long donated millions to groups such as the Foundation for Christian Athletes and the Salvation Army, both of which have storied histories of being anti-LGBTQ. Today, Chick-fil-A announced it will stop donating to anti-LGBTQ organizations thanks to pressure from activists. This is not the first time, however, the company has made that promise. The first dates back to 2012, and even after the announcement, support for anti-gay groups continued. Considering the history, activists have urged a cautious optimism.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown met with Washington Governor Jay Inslee this morning to reignite their commitment to replace the interstate bridge between Washington and Oregon. Both governors expressed their intentions to revive the multi-billion dollar project, which would replace the drawbridge spanning the Columbia River. The previous efforts to replace the bridge failed back in 2013. That's when Washington lawmakers refused to pay for their share of the Columbia River crossing project. In a statement, Governor Brown said the bridge is a major source of congestion and seismic risk. Quote, "The current interstate bridge is over 100 years old, and it's showing its age. Replacing the interstate bridge is critical to the safety and economies of both Oregon and Washington. Our states are more interconnected than ever, and by working together, we can make our communities and roads safer while we improve mobility and support the economic vitality of our communities." This past year, Oregon and Washington legislators have built up the funds necessary to restart that project, and a project office is now dedicated to it. Combined, the states have invested $44 million so far. Last week, a joint committee of Oregon and Washington lawmakers met at Portland International Airport to discuss the new bridge.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced on Monday a major reversal of the United States' longstanding policy on Israeli settlements in the occupied region of the West Bank. Pompeo said, quote, "The establishment of Israeli civilian settlements in the West Bank is not per se inconsistent with international law." The announcement officially breaks with international law and consensus and is the latest in a series of pro-Israeli changes that are likely to intensify tensions between the Trump administration and Palestinians, as well as strain the relationship between the Trump administration and U.S. allies in Europe. The policy reversal was quickly renounced by the European Union, with diplomats noting the president's tendency to pander to evangelical voters and, quote, "give the finger to international law." International law states that an occupying power cannot build civilian settlements on occupied territories, and under international law, the West Bank is seen as occupied territory. Pompeo's announcement was hailed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who faces possible criminal indictment in three corruption probes. Secretary General of the Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee, Saeb Erekat, condemned Pompeo's announcement, saying that Israeli settlements, quote, "divide, displace, and restrict the movement of the people of Palestine, and that Israel's colonial settlement enterprise perpetuates the negation of the Palestinian right to self-determination." The U.S. government does not allow officials to travel to the West Bank at this time.
Last week, Portland's Melody Event Center hosted a Rescue America Town Hall. It's an event that featured several prominent right-wing figures. Portland community groups called for the cancellation of the event due to the threat that it posed to the community. KBOO's Aaron Gray spoke with a spokesperson from the protest group Pop Mob named Effie Baum.
Last week, KBOO Evening News reported on the Rescue America Town Hall at the Melody Event Center in Southeast Portland. The town hall featured right-wing provocateurs Dinesh D'Souza, Andy Ngo, and Brandon Straka. Portland community and civic leaders called on the Melody Center owner, Alan Peters, to cancel the event because of the danger it posed to the community.
When we heard that this event was happening, we got a lot of emails and communication from community members that were concerned about this large gathering of far-right folks that could pose a threat to people that were in the neighborhood working or living, and just to Portlanders in general. And so we decided to have a call-in campaign and an email campaign to try to get the event canceled, because an event like this is a very good recruitment tool for the far-right to continue to recruit folks to their hateful kind of messaging.
The event advertised opportunities to meet Joey Gibson and Angela Roman. Gibson is the leader of Patriot Prayer. He is currently facing felony assault charges for his role in an attack on patrons at the Portland pub Cider Riot on May Day of this year. Roman is running for Congress and is an associate of the right-wing militia group the Three Percenters. They were both uninvited from the event by the Melody Center due to pressure from the community. Melody Event Center owner Alan Peters issued a statement that he, quote, wants the community to know that he will not allow any presenters in our facility that promote racism, anti-LGBTQ rhetoric, or that incite or promote violence. The statement continues, it came to our attention that some groups that promote those very ideas were invited into our space. There is no question that those groups will not be allowed into our space. For more on why Pop Mob continued to call for the event to be canceled after Gibson and Roman were uninvited, KBU heard from their spokesperson, Effie Baum.
Both of the people that were the main speakers at this event have a long history of anti-LGBT, anti-Islamic, anti-immigrant, and just plain like racist speech on their personal Twitter accounts and online, let alone the fact that some of the people that were in attendance, I saw a picture of Tara LaRosa with Brandon Straka, and she is a well-known associate of Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys. She was a big proponent of the August 17th Joe Biggs event that happened in Portland. She has also spewed a ton of violent rhetoric online. So definitely somebody who very publicly promotes violence was in attendance.
On Wednesday, the Portland Mercury reported that a fight had broke out between two women at a Proud Boys rally in Portland. One of the women was LaRosa. In audio recorded on her phone, the other woman is heard saying, "I can't breathe." And LaRosa replies, "I don't care." No arrests have been made yet as a result of the fight. Baum spoke about the scene outside of the event.
I drove by that event that night. I was meeting some friends at another bar nearby, and I saw groups of Proud Boys that were openly walking around in groups of like four or five, looking very intimidating and aggressive, within a block or two of the event, kind of just patrolling.
KBU reached out to two local bars who were open during the event, and both declined to speak on record. KBU also reached out to the Melody Center for an interview for this story, but they did not respond. KBU had hoped to get insight regarding factors that made them uninvite Gibson and Roman and what made them decide to host the walkaway campaign town hall. In a tweet after the event, D'Souza mocked the counter-protesters and stated that they were fortunate to have armed security that kept them subdued. While Pop Mob had organized a call-in campaign to get the event canceled, they were not involved in the counter-protest because the event had attracted right-wing militia groups and they said it would be unsafe.
And there was a woman I saw walking around with a baton, very openly wearing like a camo vest right in front of the main entryway. There were people that were seen open carrying firearms walking around the vicinity as well. I also wanted to point out one of the other speakers was Andy No, who is a threat to our community and provides kill lists for Adam Waffen.
The allegation refers to a video posted to YouTube earlier this year by an associate of Adam Waffen Division, a neo-Nazi group that has been responsible for five murders. According to an article published by the New Republic in June, the video featured the names and faces of journalists, activists, and friends. It also features, quote, imagery of mass shooters intercut with images of the reporters mentioned by Lenihan under the heading Sunset the Media. No has denied he is responsible for the list, despite being in charge of Quillette when it was published. Though the Melody Event Center decided to host the event despite their calls to cancel it, Pop Mob praised the community response.
We drew a lot of attention to the fact that the event was happening in our city, and there was a lot of everyday anti-fascists that was very outspoken in our community about the fact that we don't want this here. And so once again, it showed that like Portland is a united city full of people that don't want this kind of hate and bigotry in our city.
For KBU Evening News, I'm Aaron Gray.
Can you identify a phone scam? A phone call that says there is a warrant out for your arrest and you must pay your bail over the phone immediately sounds pretty sketchy, but consider that phone call coming from what appears to be an official police number with the person calling having the name of a real officer. That's the scam call that's been circulating in Northwest Oregon recently. The scammer identifies himself as Sergeant Peter Simpson with the Portland Police Bureau, and the caller ID shows up as the police non-emergency line. The number to call back is different, however, and that's the tip-off. One victim's daughter turned to the internet. There they found old videos of Sergeant Simpson when he was the spokesperson for the Portland Police and compared them to the voice on the phone. Of the reported victims to the scam, none have fallen for it, but scams like this have cost others thousands in the past. The Portland Police remind the public that the Bureau does not call individuals and demand or request money under any circumstances, nor does any other legitimate law enforcement agency. If you are a Portland resident and fall victim to a scam and lose money, you can report it to the police non-emergency line at 503-823-3333.
Former President Barack Obama is finally weighing in on the 2020 presidential election by saying he believes that most Americans don't want to tear down the system. But while some Democrats running for the 2020 nomination are fighting for justice, others are campaigning because they think they're the only candidate who can beat Donald Trump. Lily Bolke has more on that story with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa. Former Vice President Joe Biden skipped his third major California Democratic Party event this weekend. His absence gave another chance for frontrunners to emerge. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was well-received by the state party's liberal base, according to the Associated Press. But former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, not so much. He criticized some of the more popular Democratic candidates the day he announced he's running.
I think that if we want solutions that last, they can't be solutions that feel to the voting public as if they are just Democratic solutions.
Former President Barack Obama joined the primary conversation, advising Democratic hopefuls about healthcare and immigration specifically that most Americans don't want to, quote, tear down the system. Some contenders pushed back. Sanders said he's fighting for justice, not tearing down the system. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker cautioned, quote, whoever is the nominee, we have one shot to make Donald Trump a one-term president, unquote. And he wants people to, quote, stop drawing artificial lines. Patrick agrees with most other candidates that politics has to change. But he's running because, he says, some plans are too bold.
Misses the moment. Because, you know, the one truth, in my opinion, that candidate Trump spoke in 2016 was when he said that conventional or establishment politics isn't working well enough for most people.
Entrepreneur Andrew Yang, once thought of as a long-shot candidate, is now consistently among the top six in national polling, though he's still close to 20 points behind the frontrunners.
I am the candidate that's best positioned to beat Donald Trump in the general election. The voters here in New Hampshire are realizing that. That's one reason my poll numbers are rising. And Democrats in Iowa and around the country are realizing it as well.
In Iowa, though, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg soared ahead of the pack for the first time last week, polling at 22 and 25% in the most recent surveys. In Saturday's Des Moines Register CNN Seltzer poll, Elizabeth Warren was at 16% and Biden and Sanders tied at 15%. Polls turned out to be accurate in the Louisiana governor's race this weekend, where incumbent Democrat John Bel Edwards won with a narrow lead, despite President Trump campaigning for Edwards' opponent, Republican Eddie Rasponi, with inflammatory rhetoric that did not achieve his goal.
Your vote on Saturday is your chance to show the radical left Washington Democrats that Louisiana rejects their extremism.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar referenced the recent Kentucky governor's race as well, where a Trump-backed incumbent Republican lost to a Democratic challenger, tweeting, quote, second governor's race in 2 weeks in red state where Trump campaigned, and a Dem won. Where else can we send him? From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke, and Chris Anderson worked on this episode. Thanks to Kevin Bowe for Deval Patrick's New Hampshire interview, and thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The Portland Police Bureau rejected a recommendation by the Training Advisory Council to include race and ethnicity data from the U.S. Census Bureau in reports that track use of force by officers. Created in 2012, the Training Advisory Council's mission is to provide ongoing advice to the police department in order to continuously improve training standards, practices, and outcomes. If used in the reports, The census statistics would aid in contextualizing use of force data to hopefully provide transparency about which groups are impacted when police use non-deadly force. The council made the recommendation to the Police Bureau in March, with the Bureau's response coming 6 months later. Danielle Droppers, a volunteer who has served on the council for 2 years and was a major proponent in pushing forward the recommendation, resigned this week due to what she says are, quote, untimely responses to our recommendations. Droppers said that for some time now, the council has been informally recommending the Police Bureau add demographic data to its force reports, but has been receiving considerable pushback, leading to the council making its formal recommendation in March. The council did note the Bureau includes demographic data in its reports on motorists stopped by officers, but again asked why the Bureau doesn't do the same for its force reports. The Police Bureau does quarterly and annual breakdowns on the types of force used by its officers, but not on the demographics of the people subjected to that force.
Rodney Reed, the death row inmate in Livingston, Texas, who was scheduled to be executed by lethal injection on November 20th, will have his execution stayed by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. In recent weeks, Reed's case has received media attention and support from activists, celebrities, and lawmakers across the country. The Texas Board of Paroles and Pardons on Friday said they were recommending the execution be delayed by 120 days. Reed was found guilty in 1996 of the murder of 19-year-old Stacy Stites in 1986. Recent evidence, as well as four corroborating witnesses who came forward in the 11th hour, have supported Rodney's innocence, which he has always maintained. Many believe that Stites' fiancé, Jimmy Fennell, murdered her. Fennell was later convicted of the kidnapping and sexual assault of a woman in his custody while he was a police officer.
The Missing and Murdered DNA Relatives Initiative is hosting a forum this week in Gallup, New Mexico, addressing the Navajo Nation's efforts to bring home missing family members. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Alaska Federation of Natives has expressed concern over a partial shutdown of the state's ferry system linking coastal communities. The state of Alaska is balking at paying a $4 million repair bill for a vessel that's the linchpin for service to Alaska's rural panhandle. That's having ripple effects across southeast Alaska. Huna is the largest Tlingit village in southeast Alaska. Mayor Jerry Byers says local stores have been stockpiling dry goods, but fresh produce is getting harder to come by. There's been one sailing in November, and the community is bracing for a 20-day gap in December.
It's already expensive enough. If they have to fly that stuff over at 50 cents a pound, that's 8 pounds for a gallon of milk. So you're going to have to add that $4 on the cost they're already paying.
Four other communities are getting no ferries at all. All but one have no airports and are only served by seaplanes. The Alaska Federation of Natives passed a resolution this year calling for full funding to the state's ferry system following cuts to funding and schedules. A New Mexico tribe and federal officials plan to discuss the return of a sacred item. Acoma Pueblo leaders and officials with the U.S. Attorney's Office for New Mexico, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Bureau of Indian Affairs are hosting a press conference Monday in Albuquerque. The tribe for years has been working with officials and politicians on the return of Native sacred items up for auction in Paris. U.S. lawmakers are seeking to prohibit the export of Native sacred items and increase penalties for the illegal trafficking of Native cultural items. The Bipartisan Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony, or STOP Act, was reintroduced this summer in the Senate. The Missing and Murdered Diné Relatives Initiative is hosting a forum this week in Gallup, New Mexico. The working group is addressing the Navajo Nation's efforts to bring home missing family members and bring justice to Navajo families. Jolene Holgate is the coordinator for the group. She says they're working with various Navajo leaders, including the tribal council.
Through the leadership of Council Delegate Amber Crotty, she did get a group of us together, and we collaborate with the Navajo Nation Missing Persons Updates. As we were able to really take a look at what was happening on Navajo, we realized that MMDR was a very large issue, and there was no data being tracked, there was no cases being tracked. And because of that, we wanted to create a data institute, which would really give our nation a more clear picture of what is going on, the perpetrations, the hotspots, anything you name it, but as well as providing recommendations for change to leadership and to public safety to support them. The families came to us. The spirit of what we do is their voice and what it to meet their needs.
Advocate Meski Yatsati is the founder of Navajo Nation Missing Persons.
It happened in my family, and it continues to happen on the reservation, which a lot of people were not aware of. So I felt that it was something that I needed to bring to the attention of the public and the communities. My strongest message is that that all genders should be included. So when we talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women, we also need to include our LGBTQ and also our men and our boys.
This will be the third forum held by the group. Previous forums were held on the Navajo Reservation and in Flagstaff, Arizona. Various organizations and advocacy groups are expected to attend, including the New Mexico Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force. The public is invited to give testimony. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jan Dworkin, author of Make Love Better, which just won a 2019 Best Book Award in the Self-Help Relationships category. At 6 o'clock tonight, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, rain with a low of 50. Tomorrow will bring morning showers and a high of about 54. Today in history, in 1939, the writer, environmental activist, and teacher Margaret Atwood was born. She turns 80 today. The quote of the day is from Margaret Atwood, who wrote in her novel, The Penelopeiad, quote, "Water does not resist. Water flows. When you plunge your hand into it, all you feel is a caress. Water is not a solid wall. It will not stop you. But water always goes where it wants to go, and nothing in the end can stand against it. Remember, you are half water. If you can't go through with an obstacle, go around it. Water does."
President Donald Trump said on Twitter today that he'll, quote, "strongly consider testifying in writing as part of the ongoing impeachment inquiry." The inquiry began on September 24th of this year following a whistleblower complaint from a U.S. intelligence officer alleging Trump pressured Ukraine to investigate his political rivals in exchange for military aid and diplomatic favor. In his morning tweets, Trump claimed the rules of the inquiry are, quote, "rigged" by the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff. Speaking to reporters in Kentucky on Monday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he, quote, "can't imagine a scenario in which the Senate would vote to remove Trump if he's impeached by the House." Meanwhile, David Holmes is set to publicly testify on Thursday as part of the inquiry. Holmes was the counselor for political affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine and previously said in closed-door testimony that he overheard U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, say to Trump that Ukrainian President Zelensky would, quote, "do anything you ask for." The House is also reportedly investigating whether Trump lied to former special counsel Robert Mueller on written answers he provided in the Russian investigation.
A New York man who had been missing for 33 years was found alive and well in Oregon this month. Rick Hazleton left Glen Falls, New York back in 1986, hoping to launch a music career in New York City. After years of silence, Hazleton's family had him legally declared dead in order to settle a will. But a childhood friend and now retired police officer, Brian Pinchian, spent years trying to find Hazleton. To Pinchian's surprise, Hazleton was alive and living 3,000 miles away in Oregon with a wife and two children. Hazleton was astonished but happy to hear from his childhood friend, saying, quote, "I didn't think anybody really cared, so I just made my own life and did it. When I called my family, they were like, 'Oh, you're back from the dead.'" Hazelton has lived in Oregon for 20 years, but after months of planning, he made his way back to Glen Falls to see his childhood friends once again. The group organized a game of kickball Sunday on the same playground where they used to play together as children. Pynchon was described as being overwhelmed to have reconnected with his dear friend, saying, quote, "If you love somebody, don't ever give up on them. If you don't have an answer, keep going until you can find out what actually happened."
And here's another missing person report with a happy ending, only this time the person is a cat. That cat had been missing for 5 years from its home in Portland, Oregon, and she's been found now in Santa Fe, New Mexico. According to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, a black cat named Sasha was found wandering around the streets of Santa Fe. After scanning Sasha's microchip, the shelter discovered the cat had traveled over 1,200 miles from Portland. 31-year-old Victor Usoff says he reported Sasha missing 5 years ago and was shocked to receive a call from the shelter saying they had found his cat. Usoff now says he's so thankful Sasha's alive and well. He says the cat's quite friendly and most likely hitched a ride with a traveler, going on what Usoff calls a great American adventure. The shelter says it was lucky Sasha was microchipped, since microchipping your pet is the only form of permanent pet identification that cannot be altered or removed.
Burning coal is known to release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, contributing to global warming. But according to a recent report, the coal mines themselves are releasing millions of tons of methane, a potent greenhouse gas far more destructive to the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. With that story and more, it's This Week in Water.
Weather whiplash will get worse in a warmer world. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Burning coal releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, contributing to global warming. But according to a new report from the International Energy Agency, coal mines themselves are releasing millions of tons of methane before coal even reaches a power plant.
Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, far stronger than carbon dioxide, even if shorter-lived. According to NOAA, the rise in methane last year was the third largest in two decades.
Previous studies have attributed the increased methane to melting Arctic permafrost, the destruction of wetlands, and belching cows.
In its annual report, the IEA estimated that nearly 40 million tons of methane seeped from new and unused coal mines last year, as much as the aviation and shipping industries combined.
The Guardian reports that China is by far the largest source of coal mine emissions, with Russia, the U.S., India, and Australia among the worst.
The IEA also revealed last week in its annual outlook that carbon emissions from the energy industry reached a new record last year, despite a recent boom in renewables.
Atmospheric blocking events are high-pressure systems that stay in place for days or even weeks. They can cause downpours, droughts, heat waves, and even cold spells.
These stalled high-pressure weather systems have already produced some of the 21st century's deadliest heat waves, such as those in France in 2003 and in Russia in 2010.
A new study from Rice University shows that high-pressure blocking events will increase in size by nearly 17% because of man-made climate change.
And the size is very important because the blocking events are more impactful when they're larger.
For example, if the high-pressure system increases in size, the result will be bigger heat waves that affect larger populations.
And in related news, many people have noticed wild swings in weather from one extreme to the other. There's a term for this, weather whiplash. Yale Environment 360 reports that the phenomenon is likely to increase as the world warms.
Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at UCLA, said that there has been an assumption that the main effect of climate change is increased temperatures, decreased snowpack, and higher risk of wildfire.
While those things are still true, he said, there's another dimension we'll have to deal with: the increased risk of extreme flood and drought and rapid transitions between the two.
The cause of weather whiplash may be disruptions in the polar vortex, which is a wall of wind that constantly circles the Arctic. Normally, it prevents warm air from penetrating the cold regions and cold air from moving south.
When it's stable, the vortex produces the usual seasonal weather, but when it's not, it causes abnormal and extreme conditions. An example of weather whiplash is the flash drought that occurred across the southern U.S. in late September.
There's a device in your home that could one day provide critical information about your health in near real time, your toilet.
A team of researchers from the University of Wisconsin is designing a toilet that will include a portable mass spectrometer that can detect different urine samples and process them to measure a variety of markers.
The concept of a smart toilet is linked to the team's findings that urine contains a liquid history of nutritional habits, exercise, medication use, sleep patterns, and other data.
Urine also contains metabolic links to more than 600 human conditions, such as cancer, diabetes, and kidney disease.
The two lead authors of the study collected their own urine over 10 days and submitted the samples for testing.
They found that the urine does contain a health fingerprint that showed things such as coffee and alcohol consumption, and even the active ingredient in Tylenol. The testing also showed metabolic output from exercise and sleep.
The authors say that smart toilets could be very useful for an aging population to indicate whether medications are being taken properly and having their intended effects.
While the smart toilet isn't a done deal yet, the next step is to design one that's simple and cheap. And finally, during disasters like wildfires, floods, and hurricanes, we sometimes forget that animals are affected, especially wildlife that doesn't have access to weather reports and fire maps to guide them out of harm's way.
So it's with great relief that we see pictures of horses able to flee fires or animals being reunited with family. But sometimes animals are on their own, like the wild horses and cows that lived on North Carolina's Cedar Island when Hurricane Dorian struck last September.
When the storm blasted the island with Category 1 force winds and rain, locals told the Charlotte Observer that it was like a mini tsunami that sent a surge of water 8 feet high onto the shore.
Most assumed all the animals drowned, and many did. But last month, park officials at the Cape Lookout National Seashore came across a surprising scene. A trio of cows hanging out and munching grass along the island's shoreline, 4 or 5 miles from their home back on Cedar Island.
Park spokesperson B.G. Horvat told McClatchy News Service that he thinks the cows swam the distance, pushed along by storm surge. He said the animals were lucky to have not drifted out into the Atlantic, where they would have likely perished.
Cows are good swimmers, and it's not uncommon to see them paddling through floodwaters after heavy rainfall, according to reference.com.
Plans are underway to return the animals to Cedar Island, a return trip by ferry that should be a lot less harrowing.
You can keep this newscast afloat by going to h2oradio.org, where your gift will be doubled dollar for dollar now until December 31st.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, whose North American Water Loss Conference will showcase innovative solutions December 3rd through 5th in Nashville. Get the details at awwa.org/waterloss.
A large inflatable poo was installed in Portland's Pioneer Square on Sunday. The poo, dropped by the company Poo Pourri, is intended as part of a campaign for World Toilet Day, an official United Nations observance day intended to bring awareness to the global sanitation crisis. As part of the attraction, visitors can take a tour of the poo, which features light projections and non-operational toilets that have interactive iPad tablets. Over 2 billion people across the world do not have access to toilets, and poor sanitation is linked to the spread of disease, higher risk of sexual assault, and malnutrition. The giant poo will remain on display in Pioneer Square until Tuesday, and for every visitor to come through for the free tour, $2 will be donated to the World Toilet Organization, a global nonprofit committed to improving sanitation conditions worldwide.
A mail-in HPV test increased cervical cancer screening rates by 50%. That's according to a new study. Eric Tagetoff has the story.
An at-home test could be a major breakthrough for screening cervical cancer in women, according to a new study. Researchers at the University of Washington and Kaiser Permanente, Washington, teamed up on a study involving 20,000 women who weren't getting regular screening. Half were mailed home tests for human papillomavirus, or HPV, the virus that can cause cervical cancer. The other half received just standard care, such as annual reminders for preventive screenings. Diana Buest, senior investigator at Kaiser Permanente Washington Health Research Institute, says the male test increased screening rates by 50%.
Which is a lot. The women that we tested the home test kit on were underscreened, which means that they were overdue for cervical cancer screening, and that's about 1 in 4 women in the United States, and 50% of cervical cancers are diagnosed in those women.
About 12,000 women are diagnosed with cervical cancer each year. Buest says screening rates are declining across the country. She notes home-based testing has been offered in other countries, but this is the first trial of home kits in the U.S. Rachel Weiner, an epidemiology professor at the UW School of Public Health and lead author of this research, says studies have shown there's no difference between the results from at-home tests and ones performed by physicians. She says health professionals are looking to overcome the barriers to screening more women.
It can be hard to find time to come in, difficulties taking time off of work or finding childcare or transportation. In addition, many women have had negative experiences with cervical cancer screening or pelvic exams in general.
Weiner says not all the women who tested positive followed up, and so the next step will be figuring out how to get them to see a physician. But she notes 88% of women who did the home kit tested negative.
That means that if you were to roll this out, only 12 out of 100 women who did this would actually need to come in for additional follow-up. So you're saving the need for that clinic visit for 88% of women.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Harrison Dillard, four-time Olympic gold medalist, died Friday in Cleveland, Ohio at the age of 96. At one time, Dillard held every world hurdles record for outdoor and indoor track. Between 1947 and 1948, Dillard won 82 consecutive finals for indoor and outdoor, high and low hurdles, and sprints. Dillard broke 11 world and Olympic records. He began his track career with street sprints with neighbors, and when Dillard was 13, he watched a parade honoring Olympian Jesse Owens. It was then Jesse gave acknowledgement to Harrison and his friends. This sparked Dillard's tenacious strides towards training, despite equipment and seasonal obstacles. He went on to become the only male runner in history to win Olympic gold in both a dash and high hurdles. Dillard is survived by his daughter Terry and his three grandchildren.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 18, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Janai Boyer and Aaron Gray. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Ted Jones with a Z. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, of course, at 7, it is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, on Alternative Radio, we hear a lecture from linguist and scholar Noam Chomsky about the threats to peace and the planet. At 10 a.m., it is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio, where host Mae Roberts will be talking with the creators behind A Christmas Cuento Remix, a Latinx twist on A Christmas Carol, coming soon to the Milagro Theater. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Jordy Duckler and Mary Dawn Duckler about their pop-up library, which merges books and nature through a maximalist collection of drawings, poems, and found objects. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you would like to become a member, we strongly encourage you do so. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
To paraphrase a famous British actor, dying is easy, relationships are hard. Our in-depth guest today has written a new book designed to make that relationship part a little easier. The book is called Make Love Better: How to Own Your Story, Connect with Your Partner, and Deepen Your Relationship Practice. The author is Jan Dworkin, a Portland-based couples therapist and relationship coach. Make Love Better recently, very recently, just about a few days ago, won a 2019 Best Book Awards in the self-help relationships category. And we're fortunate to have Jan with us now live in the KBOO studios to talk about the book and how to deepen our own relationships. Jan Dworkin, thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you for having me, Ken. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Jan, though Make Love Better can be considered a self-help book, and at least it recently won the Best Book Award in that category. Congratulations on that, by the way. You also include a lot of your own personal story. Did the book originate as a memoir?
Well, in fact, I did write a version that was a memoir some years back. But interestingly enough, that memoir was really about me working out my own relationship issues.
And there's still some of that in the book.
Well, I think hopefully in the book, my relationship issues, I've sort of understood, and I've been able to process them in such a way that they become hopefully useful for other people.
They become lessons in the book, in fact.
Exactly. Whereas that first memoir that I wrote, I think I was still seeking revenge and working out my issues. And I was using it as more of a journal than really a learning tool for others. So I decided at that time not to try to publish it.
Now, what was, I guess those life lessons then, was the reason for including all the personal material? I mean, after working it out on your own, and so it's no longer a memoir, it's now really a self-help book, but using your own story as illustrations. You mentioned two marriages, you've lived with three partners, and you also mentioned many not-so-wonderful dates that you gathered from the internet to online. So what was the reason for that? Was, again, just to kind of show other people that you know, everybody has problems with relationships. There's no perfect, even though you're got a doctorate, you're not perfect at it.
Exactly. I'm far from perfect at it, and none of us are. And I think really my deepest motivation was to sort of eliminate some of the shame and isolation and alienation that people feel when they're going through very, very difficult relationship processes and times, because most of that is hidden from the general public and even from our friends and community and family. People on social media don't usually show up and talk about their worst problems that they're having at home. So I felt so alone when I was going through my own hardships in relationship, and I felt like I wanted my troubles to somehow be made useful for other people. And I didn't want others to have to experience the kind of isolation and despair, really, that I was experiencing, and that's what motivated my book.
And you actually have a very interesting perspective on what some people might call relationship failures.
Yes, I do.
You regard them more as lessons to learn.
Exactly.
And early in your career, you went to Zurich. I think you were studying for an MFA here, and you ended up with a Jungian analyst there in Zurich. And you have a quote from Jung himself in the book, which I think helps describe your own approach, so I'll read it. "The serious problems in life, however, are not fully solved. If ever they should appear to be so, it's a sure sign that something has been lost. The meaning and purpose of a problem seems to lie not in its solution, but in our working at it incessantly." Can you talk about that bit of wisdom and how it influenced your work and the book?
I'm really touched, Ken, that you chose that quote and that you're asking me about it, because it's something that's very, very meaningful to me. And I think this whole idea of repeating experiences is something that is very universal, but something that people tend to very often criticize themselves for, especially in relationships. When you work with people in therapeutic practice, they often say, "Why did I do that again? And why did I choose the same kind of partner? And I'm really poor at choosing, and I keep repeating my mistakes." And the reason we repeat things is because we can't learn unless we get another chance to practice.
And you even mentioned the cult movie Groundhog Day,
exactly,
where the main character goes through that exact exercise, just reliving the same day until he gets it right.
Exactly. And many of us experience our relationships like Groundhog Days over and over again. It's like you meet somebody, and when you first meet them and you go on a few dates, you think they're totally different than anybody you ever got together with before. But after living with them a year, you find out, oh my God, I'm in the same situation again. You know, most people feel despairing about that. But another way to look at it is, here's a chance. If I learn some new skills and I learn some things about myself and I really develop self-awareness and I really develop a relationship practice, maybe I could try something different this time. It's even if the other is the same, I can show up differently, and then maybe something transpires that's completely unknown.
And that's really a tack that you take throughout the book.
Yes.
There's really no failures. They're all learning experiences.
Yes, exactly.
Now, the book itself is divided into three parts. Own It, The World Inside.
Mm-hmm.
Connect, The World Between. And the final section is Deepen, The World Around. And that, of course, mirrors the book's subtitle, How to Own Your Story, Connect with Your Partner, and Deepen Your Relationship Practice. Why'd you format the book in this way? Is that how you approach a therapy, kind of that personal story, then the relationship itself, and then that relationship in the context of everything else that's going on in that person's life?
That's exactly right. I mean, there's so many different aspects of that I could speak about. But basically, I think the more self-awareness you have and you, the more you know yourself, the more you're able to show up in relationship in a way where the emphasis is on how you can change your behavior as opposed to how you can change your partner. Because most of us emphasize how we can change our partner.
And we really cannot be very successful at that.
It doesn't work all that well, unfortunately. And believe me, I've tried. But unfortunately, it doesn't work all that well. And then once you do connect with somebody and you show up with a little bit more awareness about yourself, there's so many things that have to be navigated in relationship. Power, communication, sex, all of these interpersonal issues that really we need skills to deal with and to navigate, and most of us don't learn
those skills. We don't have relationship skills. It's not taught in school.
Exactly. Mm. So I teach a lot of those skills in the book. And then our relationships are embedded in the world around us, and we can't really think about our relationships in isolation, because all of the social issues and all of the world issues and the diversity issues and the power dynamics that exist and the inequities that exist in the world also exist between people in relationship. And unless we take in the social context, we can work on our personal psychologies and our interpersonal relationship forever. But unless we really look at social injustice and imbalances and how they're impacting us in how we relate to our partners, then we can only go so far.
Now, you start off with the very personal in the book, and that's the individual, him or herself.
Mm-hmm.
And you give a good example of childhood dreams. Again, that might be part of your Jungian background.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Freud in the book, too. So you had a childhood dream of based on a real experience of a
yes.
beggar chasing
yes.
you, a blind beggar. And then
yes.
there was one that you saw that was limbless, without
yes.
arms and legs. And these kind of nightmares occurred where these characters intensified
that's right.
in your brain, in your dream world,
exactly.
Were coming after you.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the story that you garnered from that?
Yes, that's also a very profound part of my own personal path and my personal journey. One, I was chased by these disabled people or so-called crippled people in my childhood dream, and those figures became very meaningful to me. And so in my dream, I turned away from them. I ran away from them. But my life journey has been a journey of turning towards that part of myself and turning towards my own vulnerability and my own limitations and my own so-called mistakes and the parts of myself that are imperfect, and learning how to embrace those, not just embrace those parts, but see them as some of the most powerful parts of myself. Now, interestingly enough, those patterns that occur in our childhood dreams also repeat in our relationships. So I tended to have relationships with people that I sometimes experienced as beggars, that I had to give so much, or I had to overgive. Or at other times in relationship, I found myself being so needy that I felt that I was sometimes begging for my partner's love. So those themes repeated throughout my life and repeated in my relationships.
And that's something that when you're working with a couple or, well, an individual at first in therapy, you would ask them if they are certain dreams that they remember from their childhood, and then try to find a little bit meaning in that and maybe how their life and their relationship experience has mirrored that.
Absolutely. And the same thing for couples' dreams. Couples also have what I call a childhood dreams or origin dreams. The funny stories, the interesting things that happen when they got when they first get together, the uncanny events.
But reality, though, it actually happened to them, and it becomes almost kind of a fable or
like a pattern or a blueprint for things that are going to happen again and again in the relationship. Or sometimes nighttime dreams. Sometimes the first time somebody spends the night in the bed with the new partner, they have a dream. And those dreams also are very significant.
Here's a very important part I want to get to, because you make it a big part of the book. You write in the book's introduction, when it comes to relationships and most things, I do not have a normal to promote. In fact, I'm against the idea of normality, especially in the realm of love. How would you describe that normality, and why can it be non-productive or even harmful?
I mean, just the whole heteronormative ideal, the idea that a cisgendered woman and a cisgendered man are supposed to come together in relationship and have a couple of children and behave in a certain way and have jobs and achieve certain financial goals, and all of that pressure from society to be normal is extremely destructive, because many of us are so individual and many of us don't fit in.
That normality doesn't apply to most people, I would think.
To many, many people, and many of us have been hurt and injured by our families, who wanted us to show up in a particular kind of way in order to reflect them, or by society, who puts its ideals onto us. And I'm just against all of that. I think it's very destructive.
Now, towards the end of the book, and this is where you're putting relationships in that wider context, you mentioned some really interesting statistics from the Pew Research Center survey. Mm-hmm. There was one 2015 survey they did where they found that all newlyweds in the U.S. had a partner, or 70% of all newlyweds, mm-hmm. had a partner of a different race or mm-hmm. ethnic group. Mm-hmm. And according to a more recent polling they did in 2017, 62% of Americans support same-sex marriage. And that was up from 35% just about 15, 16 years earlier. Incredible in terms of the increase there.
Yes.
And I know young people that I know, it's almost like a given. You know, what's so strange about same-sex relationships?
Exactly.
It's usually old people who seem to mm-hmm. bear those prejudices. Mm-hmm. That was something you definitely reflect in the book. Can you talk about some of those challenges that you find in these relationships and how you help couples deal with them, say same-sex or people of different ethnic groups or races?
Well, everybody is so different that I can't really generalize about what kinds of struggles that the individuals within the relationship have. However, if you are in a relationship that is in any way a challenge to mainstream norms, you have extra challenges that come from the society and the culture itself. So you not only have the challenges of just being two diverse human beings trying to get along, and by diverse I mean just different people with all of your internal differences and external differences, but then you have extra pressures from society who are looking at you and expecting you to fail, or putting more pressure on you to succeed, or just watching you to see, can two people who are that different, or two people of the same gender, how do they do raising children together?
Yes.
And what we're testing, we're looking at you, the eyes are on you in the world in a different way that if you're a mainstream couple, if you're more typical, then you don't have that kind of pressure.
Yeah, those are kind of instances where I guess it's a difficult. You're almost like a test case.
Exactly.
Same-sex marriage, is that going to work? Interracial marriage, is that going to work? And that just is a lot of added stress.
Exactly.
Now, most self-help books don't go into that, but you do that here.
No, I do also, because I think that couples that can work out those kinds of power issues and differences and imbalances and cultural differences in their relationship are doing that for themselves, but they're also helping the world by doing that. It's a deep belief of mine. So I really celebrate couples who are navigating power differences and diversity issues.
I had a lot more questions for you, but I probably have time for just one more, Jan. And this one, if there's one thing an individual listening today in a challenging relationship for any reason can start working on today in addition to buying the book and reading and doing some of the exercises,
yes.
What would you suggest?
One suggestion? Ask me the question again. I don't think I understood it.
Oh, okay. If there's one thing that you can, one piece of advice where a person in a challenging relationship can start doing something positive, constructive for that relationship, what would you suggest? What would be that first step?
I think a first step is to just really study yourself and understand what you're bringing to the relationship that's difficult.
And that's in part one in the book.
That's the individual. But I also encourage people to have the courage also to leave relationships, especially if they're harmful to you.
Well, thank you, Jan. It's a very enlightening book. Again, I wish we had more time to go into it, but you can pick up a copy.
It was
published just about a week or so ago, and it's on sale everywhere. Good books are available. Jan, thanks very much for joining us at KBOO today.
Thank you for having me, Ken. It's great to be here.
We've been talking with Portland-based couples therapist and relationship coach Jan Dworkin about her new book, Make Love Better, How to Own Your Story, Connect with Your Partner, and Deepen Your Relationship Practice. The book recently won a 2019 Best Book Award in the Self-Help Relationship category. You can learn more about Jan and her work and her book online at janjorkin.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
And now it's very nearly 6 p.m. This is KBOO, Portland, Oregon. And coming up is the prison pipeline, I think.
Oh, Lordy me, yes, it's so Lordy mine. Who's gonna be your man?
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society concert season. On Friday, November 22nd, the Honey Whiskey Trio returns to the PFS stage. Prior to the concert, the Honeys will conduct a vocal workshop. Attendees will learn shape note singing, body percussion, and shout songs. The workshop will be held from 3:30 to 5:30 p.m., followed by the concert starting at 7:30, doors at 7. The concert and workshop will be held at Reedwood Friends Church at 2901 Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart, and joining me as always
is Elliot Gilland.
And we are coming to you from the beautiful KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. Tonight we have a lot of interesting labor-related topics to discuss. But first off, Elliot, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. We're on during the Blazer game,
yeah,
which is always a peak time. But yeah, excited to be here.
Yeah, hopefully some folks are switching between the game and timeouts and listening to us here.
Mm-hmm.
Go Blazers, obviously. So we're going to jump right in. The first story we want to